KALW.
And it was like Grand Central Station during the pandemic. I had never seen so many people come down here.
The Morecambe Rose Garden in Oakland saw a huge uptick in visitors during the pandemic.
In its day, at one point, we had 8 full-time gardeners. It was beautifully groomed. The city today has limited resources.
We'll meet the volunteers who maintain the garden despite the difficulties of the past 2 years. Then we hear from the first American theater company devoted to the Middle East.
These plays are definitely about the Middle East. Some of them are by Middle Easterners, but I'm sure they speak to all of us.
And we'll hear a reading from Oakland author Alex Scott. That's coming up. I'm Suni Khalid in for Hana Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today we're going to stop and smell the roses with a story from our series At Work.
I have a lot of pride in my work.
How do you do it?
Sprays, masks, gloves.
I'm with the swamp team.
Hi, my friends, and how are you?
It's nice now with technology.
Pandora's box has been opened.
It's a beautiful way to make your living, but it's more work than I ever imagined.
For nearly a century, the Morecambe Rose Garden in Oakland's Grand Lake neighborhood has provided beauty and respite to locals and visitors alike. Boasting a dazzling array of several thousand roses, multiple winding walkways, a reflection pool, and fountain cascades, it's hard to deny the public park's magic. Today, KALW's Raphael Cohen introduces us to some of the volunteers who manage the garden and how they've navigated the challenges posed by the pandemic.
A hidden jewel, an urban oasis. That's what the Morecambe Rose Garden has always felt like to me. I've been coming to this serene sanctuary sporadically for the past 20 years, but I became a real regular during the pandemic. It provided some relief from the day-to-day chaos, some sensory delight and peace of mind in a period fraught with fear. So I wanted to meet some of the people who make this place go. People like Steve Gary. He's helping to put the final touches on a new irrigation system.
I was born on a ranch in Central Valley. And we had like 350 acres at one point of nectarines, peaches, plums. And so I'm familiar with that kind of agriculture. Now, roses, it's a little different story.
He's been volunteering here for the past 7 years.
My grandmother had zinnias and things like that. And roses, I didn't really have an acquaintance with. But I've gotten acquainted. I got some roses at home. They tell you, you know, when you're okay and when you're not doing okay. So, but they're pretty hardy. They're amazing.
Well, I'm a gardener by location.
That's Jane Bisek, another volunteer.
I used to walk through the Rose Garden to go to the casual carpool to work in San Francisco. So after I retired, I thought I should give back to the public space.
Today, she and several colleagues are busy weeding near the reflection pool.
The weeds are winning.
We do have a consulting rosarian that comes every day and works, and he's our teacher.
A rosarian? I'd never even heard the term. But I had seen an older gentleman in jeans and a wide-brim hat around here for years, tending to the rose bushes, whether or not they were in bloom. I'd often wonder what his story was. Now I was about to find out.
Yeah, I'm Royal Krieger, and I'm the volunteer here. I'm also the rosarian. My wife and I bought a home in the late 70s, and she wanted a little rose garden, and that soon became about 50 roses, and the gardener said, I'm not too sure about taking care of these.
Royal ended up attending a rose pruning demonstration put on by the East Bay Rose Society at the Morecambe.
Probably about 4 or 5 years later, I was one of the participants giving these demonstrations.
His career had been in the business world.
But then as I started to divest myself about 10 or so years ago, and then that led to my being the rosarian here, which is, I'll tell you, the happiest hours of my day.
In reaching out to the volunteer group, I kept running across the term dedicated deadheaders.
Anyone can be a volunteer, but to be a deadheader, I have basically a program to teach to make sure they have enough knowledge to be dangerous enough to turn them loose on their own.
I'm city-raised, and the antithesis of a green thumb, so I needed some clarity on what exactly deadheading entails. Because I genuinely thought the name was a reference to the Grateful Dead and the senior volunteers' shared enjoyment of their music. Not quite.
So deadheading is after the bloom has happened, we want to remove that spent bloom.
A dead flower to you and me.
Typically, we want to go to the first or second five leaf. We're going to cut above it about a quarter of an inch. That is now going to stimulate a new growth at that point. As long as we keep deadheading, we'll keep stimulating the plant and we'll keep getting more bloom.
How quickly can someone learn to deadhead properly?
This is a skill that frankly takes time. The more skill that you get, especially with some of the more complex roses, then you'll know in time not only am I pruning for the next bloom, which might be 5, 6, 7 weeks from now, but I'm also pruning down the line even for future years.
He says it's an art.
Think of it in a way of people become masters on bonsai. That's what happens here. And that's really an advanced level of great joy. And I'm always love to teach people, you know, those aspects.
Walking these grounds always brings me great joy. It also feels a bit like time travel, especially when I pass by the cascading fountain.
The city acquired the property about 1915 at the behest of a men's garden club. And then in 1932 to 34, it was a WPA project.
The Works Progress Administration employed millions of job seekers to carry out public works projects. And Alameda-born landscape architect Arthur Cobbledick designed Morecambe based largely on the Italian gardens he'd studied.
Many of the public gardens you'll find, they have pretty much all the same roses, and so I call them mommy pleasers.
But Royal also tries to introduce new ones every year. There are more than 2,500 roses in the Florentine area of the garden.
We have quite a few very, very rare roses. In a couple cases, we believe we probably have the only ones in the world.
Some of his favorites? The blush noisette, introduced to the public in 1814, and ones with unusual colors, like Loco Coco and Honey Dijon.
I love the more complicated roses and climbers, and we have the largest one here is Mermaid, and she's got about a 40-foot spread now.
And what, in Royal's opinion, is the most fragrant rose here?
French rose. French, I think, if I can pardon my French, is Douce Le Griffery, but I think we Yankees call it Douce Le Griffery. And it only blooms once a year. You just missed it. And you can smell that baby about a block away, and it's lovely. A big show off.
Royal says some of the most serious enthusiasts actually poke around abandoned cemeteries and old homesteads, looking for roses that may have been planted by a gravestone a century ago or more. If they find one and it can't be identified,
it's then called a found rose, and the person that found it has now the pleasure of naming the rose. And so this one here is Huntington Pink, and you've heard of Huntington down in Pasadena.
Royal believes this rose is only found in that garden and here at the Morecambe. As we continue strolling, I ask about the public's use of this space.
One of the busiest times is during prom season. And we'll have Fridays and certainly Saturday nights, we'll have as many as 500+ kids and their parents. And I couldn't figure out what was happening here because they were coming from the distances of Vallejo and Fremont. And they gather here to have pictures taken.
Before hopping in their limos and heading to the city. He says there are lots of weddings, quinceañeras, and
certainly the neighbors and the elderly. It's here as well as you can see there's many places where it's very quiet and tranquil and beautiful. You know, and a lot of people come, they're grieving for whatever reasons, and this is a wonderful place for healing too.
Which is why so many people, myself included, spent so much time here these last 2.5 years. Here's volunteer Jane Bisek again.
It was like Grand Central Station during the pandemic. I had never seen so many people come down here.
You know, we had a kind of police the place a little bit, but that sort of sorted itself out.
We've had a number of challenges. We've also had a rose thief. We've lost 80 rose bushes.
And then not long after that, we had this turkey that went rogue.
Ah, yes. The infamous turkey who took to terrorizing the garden's visitors.
He started to, started to chase and then attack people. This guy was, he was a pit bull with wings.
A local journalist dubbed the turkey Gerald.
Of course, that humanized this clown. And needless to say, Gerald and I bonded in not the most friendly way. And it was a serious, serious problem. A lot of people were seriously hurt. We made our mark on the map and not exactly the way I wanted it.
I sense Royal's slight discomfort discussing the turkey problem, but gently press him to tell me more.
Having gotten to know some of the animal rights people, I have to be very careful here.
Essentially, turkeys can tear up garden beds, pluck off new growths.
Not to mention all the poop that they do. So, yeah, they're attractive in one sense, but for a rose garden, they're a serious problem.
Royal tells me that Wildlife Emergency Services eventually captured and moved Gerald to wild land near Orinda, and that the couple turkeys that come around now are a lot less aggressive. So, he and the other volunteers have managed an errant turkey, cursed an elusive rose thief, and welcomed visitors in record high numbers, all with very little money.
The city does not provide us any funds for roses, any of the basic materials like that.
Instead, several growers donate some of their stock when they can, and the garden fundraises for more.
In its day, at one point, we had 8 full-time gardeners. It was immaculate. It was beautifully groomed. The city today has limited resources. Frankly, we're lucky to have a half-time gardener.
And so they need these volunteers to keep the weeds down and the spent blooms trimmed.
As long as we deadhead, which is basically stimulating the roses, they'll continue to bloom. And we do that. And you can imagine with 2,500 plus roses, and let's say every rose just gave 5, that's 12,500 a month. So that's a lot of work. And we obviously just have a handful of people, but we do the best we can.
Despite limited means, it's clear to me that Royal, the dozen dedicated deadheaders, and the broader volunteer group are all deeply committed to preserving this garden as a place of joy, connection, and colorful contemplation. In Oakland, I'm Raphael Cohen for Cross Currents.
Thanks, Raphael. You can find a link at our website to learn how to sign up for a tour of the Morcom Rose Garden or to find out how to volunteer. That's at kalw.org. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Suni Khalid in for Hanna Baba. San Francisco's Golden Thread Theater Company is the country's first Middle Eastern theater company. Since 1996, they've hosted plays and supported playwrights telling stories from across the Middle East with a Bay Area flavor. Starting in August, they're hosting a series of live readings by acclaimed writers at venues across San Francisco. Sahar Asaf is the executive artistic director at Golden Thread. She's Lebanese and has been part of the theater scene there as an actor, playwright, and director. KALW's Hanna Baba spoke with her about the upcoming readings. Hanna starts out by asking Sahar to recall her first time on stage in Lebanon, a time when she was trying to convince her family that she should go into theater as a career.
I was acting in a play by Ziad Rahbani, who's a Lebanese playwright and director. And the play is called Bnisbe La Bukra Shu, How About Tomorrow? And I was playing the role of a married woman who is forced by her social circumstances to prostitute herself to basically secure, you know, food for her 3 children. And he came and saw that show. And it's a social comedy, basically. The play is very funny. You know, it hurts, but it's really funny. So everyone in the auditorium were laughing. And then he was sitting in the first row, and I would like kind of see him in certain moments and he's not laughing or smiling at all. And then the next morning, I'm like, so what did you think? And he's like, oh, you all are good actors. I was like, oh, great. That's fair enough. Yeah.
You're like, I'll take that compliment.
I'll take that for sure. And eventually, when I became a teacher at the university, he was extremely proud.
Let's get talking about the 2022 reading series. Tell us about that. You are directing the first in the series. And so tell us about what the series is. It is readings of plays on stage across San Francisco. So let us know what that is.
Yeah, so the New Threads reading series is our, you know, reading series, play development. Basically, the idea is to give space for the playwrights to listen to their plays. It gives us a chance to kind of, you know, test the plays with our communities and audiences. And this year, the series includes 4 plays. And I'm directing one of the plays. That's right. It's 1,000 Strange Places, Anthony Shadid in the Middle East. And it's a recent play, a new play by Robert Myers. And it really dramatizes the life and work of the Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, reporter, Anthony Shadid, who was American Lebanese. We're also hosting Nabra Nilsson in the play is titled What to Expect When You're Simulating Expectings.
And this one is set in like the future? This is like a futuristic play. Tell us about it.
This play by Nabra is set in 2080, so in the near future. It's a near futuristic play, and it's I don't want to spoil it, obviously, for audiences, but this is a play that really touches on issues and matters that we deal with currently in a very light yet intense, you know, light comic, really. But it's going to be an intense experience, I'm sure, for audiences.
Now, this is on your website, so I think I can say it, that it involves pregnancy.
It deals with a time when pregnancy becomes a taboo. So it's quite interesting.
And then you have Pilgrimage, that is on the 23rd, that Tuesday. Tell us about Pilgrimage. This takes us to Mecca.
Pilgrimage is on Tuesday 23rd, and this is a play by Humaira Gilzai and Bridget Dota Portman. And it's a play where 5 Muslim women embark on a journey to Mecca. And the mother in the play holds a secret and, you know, is not willing to share. And it's a play about spiritual reawakening, but also family relationships. And it's a play from Afghanistan. The women are Afghani women.
And then you have on the 30th, you have a play by Hind Ayoub called Home? Question mark. Not home. Not just home, but home.
It's a fascinating autobiographical solo show about really Hind's experience trying to find home, which is something that we, you know, most of us take for granted. For Hind, it's not for granted. So yeah, these are the 4 readings, very diverse, very, you know, a common theme of journey, basically, you know, searching, whether it's a search for home or for truth or for reconciliation.
It's like a whole month of these wonderful plays that go to so many places. You meet so many people from different parts of, you know, Middle East and Middle East heritage and background. You'll be happy if people leave with what?
I will be so happy if people leave with a connection. These plays are definitely about the Middle East. Some of them are by Middle Easterners, but they also speak, I'm sure, they speak to audiences, to all of us.
Finally, what story about the Middle East has not been told yet that you would love to tell one day? What has not been done yet? Maybe because it's hard, maybe because it's controversial, that you would love to tackle?
The story of the early feminists in the Middle East, basically pioneer women who, you know, have a huge fingerprint and footprint everywhere, like Maiz Yede, like Ambar Salam, you know, women who really dare to do something different. And I'm talking about early 20th century. In general, theater about women and by women fascinates me and makes me excited, and stories about women in particular. And I feel like we have many, many, many strong and powerful and impactful women that are rarely talked about. When we talk about women in the Middle East, we always like to shed light on the oppression, on, you know, whether it's coming from religion or patriarchy or whatnot, but we don't talk about women who are changing the course of history. And that's what I would like, you know, one day at Golden Thread to be able to do.
All right. Sahara Assaf, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Hannah. It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Sahara Assaf is the executive artistic director at Golden Thread Theater Company. They're holding live play readings every Tuesday in August at venues across the city. We've got the details at kalw.org. This is Cross Currents. I'm Suni Khalid, in for Hana Baba. Now we're reading about how hard it can be to tell the truth to the people who matter most. It's another episode from KALW's literary podcast, New Arrivals.
This is New Arrivals, a pocket-sized book tour with Bay Area authors. I'm Lisa Morehouse. Alex Scott lives in Oakland. His first novel, Until It Shimmers, came out on June 24th, 2022.
It's about a young Canadian, one Ned Baldwin, who moves at the beginning of the book from Toronto to London for some jobs that'll help him figure out what he wants to do with his life. He's also moved there to come out. When his parents, Oliver and Helena, come over on a visit, he plans to tell them, gently, carefully, who he is. At last, Ned began to tell them his secret. When I dream, sometimes I have no hands. Sometimes I think of what it would be like to be gone. I know that's wrong. I never would. It's just I'm... What in the hell are you talking about? Oliver said, turning his head back to look at his son. By then, they'd reached Oxford Street and were passing in front of Debenhams, the department store where Ned bought his first suit. Oliver, Helena screamed. A black Audi had pulled from the side street in front of them. Oliver meant to brake, but found the accelerator instead. The other car got bigger quickly, and one beat, two beat, wham! Their bodies hurtled forward, then were jerked backwards by their seatbelts. I'm gay, Ned said. I've always been gay. The collision had jarred his confession loose. He couldn't believe he'd just blurted it out. Oh God, Helena said. Just let your father deal with this.
That was Alex Scott reading from Until It Shimmers.
New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. You can hear more readings at kalw.org. Today's Cross Currents team includes Hanisha Harjani, Sebastian Mino-Buccelli, Sunday Holland, James Rollins, Gabe Graben, Victor Tentz, Shireen Adel, Shia Levitt, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Suni Khalid.